You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This year marks the 400th birthday of one of the greatest works of English literature, the King James Bible. The Museum of Biblical Art is celebrating the book's turbulent history and literary influences with an exhibit called On Eagle's Wings, The King James Bible Turns 400, which features 130 different items, including various English language Bibles dating back to the 1400s. Also on view are some new works inspired by the Gospels by the artist Makoto Fujimara. The exhibit is on view now through October 19th, and I'm very pleased that it brings curators Tricia Pungrass, Director of Curatorial Affairs, and Leanna Lupus, Curator of the Rare Bible Collection, to our show today. Hello.
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 Leanna, what does the title of the exhibit On Eagle's Wings come from?
Well, like all the titles of our exhibits, it comes from the Bible itself. It's a quote.
From which part of the Bible? On Eagle's Wings. It's beautiful, but...
There is a passage in the Bible which a very popular hymn has come from, and it's called, And He Will Raise You Up on Eagle's Wings. And we thought that was very lyrical and beautiful and really embodied what the English translation of the Bible was meant to do for those people who were going to read it in their mother tongue.
Can you tell us about some of the other objects that are on view at the exhibit? You have some of the translations of Bibles that predated the King James. But they were done under duress, weren't they?
Basically, almost all the translations into English, all the translations of the Bible done before the King James were done by people who lived in exile, who ended up sometimes at the stake, who were persecuted.
Persecuted because they were translating it into the vernacular?
Yes. Basically, C.S. Lewis has a wonderful quotation when he's talking about what can be described as the extreme tension under which these translators were operating. And it was really seen, according to C.S. Lewis, as a moment in time when souls were at stake. Part of the power of the Bible was its mediation through the church, through the priests, and the fact that it was translated into Latin, and you had to hear it. The people who were not educated and not part of that elite group of people were going to have to hear this. To put it in the vernacular meant that you no longer needed the mediation.
But this was before King Henry VIII instituted Protestantism into England. So what is the oldest edition of the Bible that you have on view?
The oldest translation of the entire Bible into English was done by John Wycliffe and his followers in the 1380s. We have on display a manuscript of the New Testament in the Wycliffe translation that was copied in the 1440s, but the text itself goes back to the 1390s because it's the revision of the Wycliffeite Bible.
And what's very interesting is, despite the fact that this is in the vernacular and in an English translation, the volume itself, remember, is a manuscript, so it's in very limited supply. And it is beautifully illuminated with these wonderful initial letters that are burnished, and it's written on vellum. So this was a deluxe copy that was not meant, it's not something that I or you or anyone would have had. It was still, the materials from which it were made reflected the preciousness of the text that it translated.
But at the same time, it was illegal.
Exactly.
And how many of those survive?
Apparently, about 200-230 copies of the Wycliffeite Bible still survive, which makes it the most widely read literary text in English.
Now, how does it compare to the King James? Do we see similarities? Was it an influence on the later translation?
Basically, the King James borrowed something or built upon all the earlier English translations.
There's the Tyndale as well.
Well, the Tyndale, yes, had a great, great, absolutely paramount importance for the King James translation.
So these other translations were there, and then And then King James decides now England is a Protestant country, but still going through a painful transition from Catholicism into this new way of dealing with religion. He decides that a translation will unify the country.
Yes, this is basically how it happened. James was approached by a group of Protestant extremists who signed a petition, who collected about 1,000 signatures on a petition that basically requested Henry to move the Reformation much farther than it had been done in England.
Was this seen as a slap James in the face of the Catholics? Because, you know, in an earlier time, in 1404, it was a capital crime to read or own a Bible, and now you have a king commissioning a Bible.
Of course. Well, Henry sort of authorized in 1539 the Great Bible, and then it went back and forth between the Catholics and the Protestants. The Protestants were favored by Henry VIII in the later part of his reign and by his son, Edward VI, but then Mary Tudor, who succeeded him, turned back history and she wanted to impose again Catholicism as the dominant religion, the only religion in England.
Changed when Elizabeth became queen.
Yes, and it's changed. So at that point, it was the Catholics who went into exile, the Protestants who came back. And each of the group had their own translation of the Bible.
Now, King James was the son of a Catholic queen, wasn't he? So was this his attempt to get past that and also solidify his own reign?
King James was a believer somehow in balance and in peace. His motto, which is shown on the portrait that we have on display in the exhibition, his motto is taken from one of the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, and it says in Latin, Beati Pacifici, blessed are the peacemakers. And that was one of the ideas that were very dear to him.
Well, was the translation accepted by the Catholics? Or were they so pushed underground that it didn't, that we don't even know what they were thinking at the time?
The Catholics were really persecuted shortly after King James started. He was at first inclined to be lenient on the Catholics, but then after the Guy Fawkes incident, and things started to deteriorate for the Catholics.
Do we know who actually did these translations?
Yes, actually we do now. There was a committee including some 50-odd translators, and their names are recorded and preserved in four different manuscripts.
This has been called the most influential book ever written in English. How does it compare with Shakespeare in informing the language that we have spoken since?
What's interesting, and David Norton, the scholar David Norton, makes a very fantastic point about this. When these translators set out to put into English this sacred text, they had no idea, nor did they have any intention of making a literary translation. It was incredibly important to adhere to, as closely as possible, to the extant Latin translation that existed, because to differentiate from it in any way would therefore force the people reading it or translating it, it could push them into heresy. So they tried as carefully as possible to maintain, because what they were mediating was truth.
Of course, they got things wrong. There was no...
Yes.
The apple in the Garden of Eden was most likely a pomegranate, for example.
These things do happen, yeah.
Because they wouldn't have known pomegranates or figs and some of the other things that would have been common to the Middle East but not to England?
They may have. There's a very rich artistic tradition from which people would have drawn as well. So I'm not so sure about that. But in the notion of making a literary masterpiece was very far afield. However, the result was that what these translators were interested in doing was to not simply make a one-to-one, a line-by-line translation from the Latin. They were really interested in the grammar as well and to use the vernacular diction. And what ended up happening was something that we see today, because we do not speak in this way anymore, is so elegant and eloquent and beautiful. But at the time, a lot of it was just the common diction and rhythms of the spoken language.
Well, Shakespeare invented a lot of words. Were words invented for the King James Bible as well?
Not that I can think of right now.
What did happen was a lot of phrases that are so common to in our lingo now came to be. And there was a wonderful statistic that really brought it home in terms of how dependent are we on the King James Bible. And it was quoted actually by Leland Ryken writing in the Wall Street Journal. And he noted that in 2005, when the Bartlett's Familiar Quotation Edition decided simply to pull every familiar quotation that had been linked to the King James Version of the Bible to this translation, it was 200 pages long. And some of the phrases that we use, rise and shine, fell flat on his face, signs of the times, very apropos right now, these have all come out of this translation, and they continue to live in our vernacular tradition to this day.
Were they made available to everyone? I know in the 1700s, churches used to chain down Bibles because books were so expensive. So when did the King James start showing up in people's homes?
The first edition, printed edition of the King James Bible was published as a big folio Bible. But the price of a book in 1611, just as today, is determined to a large extent by the price of the paper that goes into its making. Already in 1612, just 1 year after the publication of the big folio edition, which would have been prohibitive for most families, smaller and more affordable Bibles started to be published. There are actually two quarto editions in 1612 and even a very small octavo edition.
So rich people could have owned their own Bibles by this time.
I guess so, yes.
The exhibit showcases a number of editions of the Bible, some that include the Apocrypha. What are the Apocrypha?
The Hebrew Bible is shorter than the Greek translation of the Septuagint. Some of the books that were originally part of the Hebrew, that were written in Hebrew, actually, didn't make it into the canon of the Hebrew Bible. By that time, they had already been translated into Greek. From the Greek, they passed into the Latin Vulgate, and they became canonical for the Roman Catholic Church. When the Reformation started, and when translators, starting with Luther, started looking back at the Hebrew and Greek text, they ended up with a dilemma because the Hebrew was shorter than the Greek and implicitly the Latin. The King James Bible included the Apocrypha. Basically, all the translations of the Bible into English. All the English translations of the Bible included the Apocrypha on a regular basis until about 1800.
Now, there have been many translations since, but the King James remains the preferred translation, despite the fact that some of the others are more accurate. Do you think it's just because of the elegance of the language?
I think it's the elegance of the language. I think it's the tradition. I think if it's a volume that you've grown up with or your family has grown up with, it's something that you tend to keep. And we know it's a perennial bestseller.
But also, it's just so beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death.
Yeah,
it is
beautiful.
I will fear no evil. I mean, you can't say it better, can you? Even if it's slightly inaccurate as a translation.
No, you can't.
Before you go, let's talk a bit about the works by Makoto Fujimara. This is a Japanese artist inspired by the King James Bible?
Mm-hmm. And what Makoto does, he's a New York-based artist. He actually just spoke with the museum last night. In honor of the anniversary of the King James Bible, a publishing house known as Crossway produced a beautiful deluxe issue of the Four Holy Gospels. And although it is not a King James Version translation, it's the English Standard Version, which is heavily dependent on the King James. And what Makoto was asked to do was to essentially visualize, to make these beautiful a frontispiece and then a large opening page for each of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then drawing on the medieval tradition to illuminate the opening chapter for each of these with an illuminated initial letter. And we have the original artwork on display.
So they're really abstract works.
They're beautiful. They're very abstract, and what Makoto is doing is really taking a 20th century abstract expressionist vocabulary, but he's working in a traditional Japanese style, and then therefore presenting these beautiful deluxe where you really come up and you look and you see the pigments and you see the minerals.
And he's using the kinds of materials that were used on the illuminated pages,
in
like
some
gold,
instances,
platinum, vermilion.
Yes. All the minerals in some instances. And what's important to remember is that though these were used in the West in the Middle Ages, the tradition in which he is painting is actually a 1,000-year-old Japanese tradition as well. So again, it shows just this wonderful confluence of materials and objects and vision.
We have a slideshow of images from the exhibit on our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to my guest, Tricia Pongratz, Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Museum of the Bible of Biblical Art, and Liana Lupus, the curator of the Scripture Collection at the American Bible Society. The exhibit on Eagle's Wings is at the Museum of Biblical Art until October 16th.
Yes, tell us, so please come.